Chairman, Father Hayden, guests and alcoholics, good morning.
Good morning.
I am Chuck C., and I am an alcoholic.
All right, Chuck.
First off, I'd like to apologize for taking so much of your time last night. I was informed after the thing was over that I'd yacked about an hour and a half. And I don't usually do that. I heard a rather dirty laugh. I think you're a long-suffering crew. Hounds for punishment to come back here again this morning. But I love you for coming. You know, many of our people think I believe that I do them a favor by making these little jaunts and attending so many meetings in my own area. But I would like to assure you that I'm doing you no favor at all. I need you much, much worse than you need me. Alcoholics Anonymous was doing very well indeed before I got here. And I wasn't. And it'll do very well after I'm gone. So I am most grateful to you for coming. I would be derelict if I didn't again thank the committee for allowing us to share this weekend with you. It's been fabulous. I happen to be a pig. You know, I thought years ago that as the years went by, I might get over the little habit of bawling. But I get worse as time goes on. And if I stand up here and cry for a while, don't pay attention to it. It's not for the same reason that I used to cry. It's because of great gratitude and a great love. Now, for those of you who might not agree with some of the things I say this morning, may I ask you right off the bat to forgive me and put it down as ignorance on my part, because I'm going to talk a little this morning about the business of living. And I would like to say right off the bat that I believe in every man's religion for him, and no man's religion but my very own for myself. How many of my Catholic friends tell me that I am a reincarnated Jesuit priest? A year or two ago, we were in Winston-Salem, and the minister didn't show up to opened the meeting at the Al-Anon luncheon, and they had me pray, and quite a few Lutherans came up and claimed me as a Lutheran because they said it was a Lutheran prayer. My Jewish friends tell me that I'm a Reformed Jew, and many in the so-called New Thought or metaphysical fields say that I'm one of them. And for this I'm very, very grateful, because I've stolen much from all of them. But I'll make a little confession to you drunks. You are stuck with me. I belong to you, whether you like it or not. Because I've stolen more from you than anybody else. We had a chap stand up here a while ago and say a few words to the name of Big Smith. He came walking into my room yesterday afternoon, and I knew that he was most familiar to me. But it took me a minute or two to place him. And I remember some 15 or 16 years ago that I met him in a meeting in California, and he'd just come up from Texas. And he had a little plaque with him, and it read something like this: if you're not as close to God as you once were, or as you would like to be, make no mistake, you're the one that moved. And I've loved this for years, and I've used it over the years. If you're not as close to God as you once were, or as you would like to be, make no mistake, you're the one that moved. And Smitty said, you see, all we have to do is to come back home, and we find that God has always been there. And then, about that time again, a chap came up to me after a meeting one night, and he says, Chuck, do you know why it's so hard for us to find God? And I, thinking I was going to have to listen to a long dissertation, and being a little bit tired, wanted to duck and get out. But I couldn't. He had me trapped. And so I had to say, no, why is it so hard for us to find God? And he says, because he ain't lost. And I've lived with this for a number of years and gotten a great kick out of it. Because he ain't lost. And then again, on a Sunday night many years ago, there were three of us standing in the room after the meeting, congratulating ourselves on our great good fortune. The good fortune of being returned from the land of the living dead into the land of the living. And there's one chap who had said nothing, and he finally looked at me and he says, Chuck, he says, I'm ignorant. He says, I never read no books. He says, there's no sense in me reading books, because I don't understand them. He says, I don't know nothing about the Bible. I don't know nothing about God. But this no man can take away from me. He says, when I practice these principles in all of my affairs, one day at a time, to the best of my ability, asking for and hoping for a little guidance from some power which I don't understand. He says, I feel clean inside and good things happen in my life. And I was speechless. And when I could talk, I said to him, son, don't ever read no books, no time. This is what the books were written about. This is the thing itself, that we might feel clean inside and have good things happen in our lives and be grateful to that great power, whatever it is, that allows these things to happen to the likes of us. I thought and still think that that's one of the greatest definitions of what happens to you and I in this great program of ours that I shall ever hear. I believe that alcoholism is a total living problem, and that you and I must find a total living answer. I think that in many areas, Al-Anon is doing a better job with our program than we are. Because, you know, we drunks come to the program with the excuse of the bottle. And on many occasions, we get sober real easy. And we say to ourselves, that's what I came for. And we settle too cheap. We don't then start working on the disease of alcoholism and rid ourselves of the causes of our discontent and our drinking. And sooner or later, life hands us a problem or a morsel that we can't chew up. And we have to wash it down. And we're off again. But the Al-Anon comes to the program without the excuse of the bottle and immediately starts working these principles, our own principles, for a living answer. And they find a living answer. It has been most gratifying to me to watch Mrs. C. in her work in Al-Anon and to see the many miracles that happen amongst the non-alcoholics, the same as we have them in AA. You know, there are not two answers. There's not one answer for me, a drunk, and another answer for you, a non-alcoholic. It's all the same answer. We are a little luckier in most instances than you non-alcoholics, because we run out of time before you do. The necessity is a little greater sometimes with us. I am convinced that we are not at fault, we Alkies. You heard me say last night that the time must come when we come to see that if there be fault, it is mine. That last excuse must go to the board, go by the boards. If there be fault, it is mine. And I say if there be fault because I do not think that there is fault. I think that we are as we are because of the combination of characteristics or attributes with which we came into this world. Now, as I said last night, I am convinced in totality that you and I are God's children. I am convinced that God has always known that we were His children, but you and I have to find it out. And I am convinced that the great love of God is such that it allows us to make our own mistakes, that we might run out of time on our own and finally come back to ourselves and to Him and discover ourselves. And in the discovery of ourselves, we know our relationship then one to another and to Him. And I think, as children of the Almighty, all of us have these attributes which I am about to mention, to a degree. I don't think they're peculiar to us, but we have them in a combination that makes it impossible for us to integrate ourselves into so-called normal society. And we are rebels. We find ourselves rebels from the very beginning. And again, I'm sure it's because of this combination. We come to the Society of Alcoholics Anonymous thinking that we're different. We think nobody has ever had our problems. We are unique. The universe has picked us out to kick us around. And if we remain, we find that we're as alike as black-eyed peas. The only difference between me and any other alcoholic in this room is that the things that happen to me. And the things that happen to you. But they were the same things. We lived in Beverly Hills during almost my entire drinking career. And we had a real nice jail in Beverly Hills. Now, I was in there many times when you were in a much lesser jail than that. But nonetheless, it was jail. And so it is good for us to come to see, that we're all alike, and that we're not unique in our suffering. Now, it has been my privilege, as many of you know, to run around this country in Canada, even Hawaiian Islands, a little, and meet alcoholics. And I've met them by the tens of thousands. And every alcoholic that I have ever known is a born perfectionist, an idealist. Regardless of race, color, or creed, regardless of educational advantages or the lack of them, regardless of environment, we are a bunch of born perfectionists, idealists, with a terrific drive that goes with the necessity for excellence. Now this is good and bad, this perfectionism. It is good in that the drive is there for excellence, but it is bad because it makes us demand perfection out of everything and everybody around us. And it makes it impossible for us to settle for the so-called normal. There isn't an alcoholic in this room that would give that much for anything that was normal. If it isn't better than normal, we don't want any part of it. And so we demand perfectionism out of life and out of the people around us, and particularly out of those who are the closest to us. I almost ruined our kids because I was demanding that they be perfect. I was telling them about me. I was telling them that I was a self-made man. I've been making my own way since I was 13 years old. And look at them. They didn't even have a paper route. I had them afraid to pick up a baseball or a football because I was a born natural at that stuff. And I wanted them to be all Americans at 6. Demanding perfection. And unable to settle for less. And so I found myself early in life a misfit. Not because I wanted to be a misfit. I wanted so much to be a part of, and I was forever apart from. I never had a drink of liquor until I was through school and out of athletics. And I was as big as them now. But from the very first, I was fighting life. Now there's another thing that came with us. Every one of us were born with the interior awareness that life is a beautiful and a big and a good thing. I like to think of a couple of lines in one of Wordsworth's poems. It went like this. Not in complete forgetfulness, nor yet in utter nakedness, but trailing clouds of glory did we come from heaven, which is our home. Now this is the interior picture that goes with the alcoholic. Life is big and it's beautiful and it's good. And we look at it and it's not. It's not according to our pattern. And we can't integrate into it. I expect many of you saw the little television show, The Days of Wine and Roses. This thing just breaks me in two. It just breaks me up. There's a little scene in it where this couple, this married couple, a couple of kids that had been alcoholic, they were real good drinkers and had a lot of fun drinking, and they finally met and got married and they had more fun drinking. And they eventually, both of them ended up as alcoholics. And they were separated. And the man had found his way in AA and his wife couldn't. And yet she loved him and she came to him high above the city of New York in his apartment to beg him to rejoin her. And she was standing there high in the building looking over the town of New York. And he was begging her to join him in this wonderful program of ours. She was standing there looking out the window and she says, I can't, I can't, I can't. She says, when I look out at this window sober, it's dirty and it's ugly. And when I look out drunk, it's beautiful. And it breaks me in two. For 25 years of my life, the only way I could stand what I saw was to be drunk. It wasn't according to my pattern. Now psychiatrists tell us that we're emotionally immature. We are alcoholics. I don't believe it. I don't believe it. I think we were born with about 10 times the capacity for feeling. That comes with the so-called normal individual. We are a bundle of emotions. We are a very sensitive lot. This might come as a shock to some of you non-alcoholics who have seen us lying in the gutter when the pig got up and slowly walked away. But you don't know how bad we were hurting. We're a very sensitive lot. We have a prison out in our country called Folsom. Folsom is a maximum security prison, and you can't even get in it for murder if it's the first time. These are habitual criminals that go into Folsom. And I've stood there in front of many more of those folks than are in this room right now, supposed to be the hardened criminal. And I have seen the whole bunch of them cry right along with me, unashamed. And it wasn't because they were emotionally immature. It was because of that great identity that one alcoholic has with another. And so, with this combination, we are trapped. We are misfits, and we don't know why. And we want so much to be a part of, and we're forever apart from. And someplace along the line, we find alcohol. And immediately, we have found an answer. Alcohol was not a problem to you and to me when we first found it. It was the great answer. We said to ourselves, where has this been all our lives? Why didn't somebody tell me about this? This is the elixir of life. Because it did two great things for us that it never does for a non-alcoholic. Number one, it allowed us to live in our own world. And number two, it took the edge off of what we saw. And for a long time, alcohol was not a problem. It was an answer. But you see, for the likes of us, there is a catch. You know, there's a little verse in the good book that says, blessed is he who condemneth not himself in that which he alloweth. If you can do a thing without self-condemnation, it's not so tough. But if you condemn yourself for doing it, you better jolly well quit it, or it'll kill you. And we, being perfectionists, don't like a bad performance. And when we drank, we did not perform according to our pattern. And there was self-condemnation. And I suspect that this is the difference between a Saturday night drunk and an alcoholic. Self-condemnation. And so, the great plummet into hell begins. Because we condemn ourselves for a bad performance. And yet remembering what this thing did for us, allowing us to, for a while, be all right with ourselves and each other in the world, and we do it again. And the next time we drink more. And the next time we condemn ourselves more. And this eventually turns into a great hatred of self. Most of us, by the time we got to Alcoholics Anonymous, couldn't even look in the mirror to shave or to powder our noses. We couldn't stand the sight of us. We hated our internal workings. And we didn't know why. There is an alcoholic in the world that likes to live the way he's living. From the very first compulsive drink to the gates of hell, an alcoholic don't like what he's doing. And I do not believe that the shakes and the miseries of mind and body are the thing that hurts the most. The thing that hurts the most is the middle of our very being, our souls. Because here we are, knowing our capabilities, going down, 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 and we don't know why. We're losing the battle of life, and we don't know why. And we hurt, and the time comes when we have to drink for oblivion because we can't stand the hurt anymore. And the answer turns into the problem. Because you see, the answer wasn't the answer we have had to have since we were born. And those of us who are fortunate find our way into Alcoholics Anonymous. And we find the answer that we've had to have all the time. The answer that we thought we had found in the bottle, we find here. We didn't come here looking for this answer. If you were like me, you couldn't even come to Alcoholics Anonymous until you'd run out of the power of choice. Because as long as I had the power of choice, my choice was not to come here. You see, I didn't even like the good people on earth. And I hated drunks. I was a drunk and I hated me and I hated all of you. And the very thought of me coming to a bunch of drunks for help was obnoxious, to say the least. And I couldn't even come until I'd run out of the power of choice. Now, I had all the problems that anybody can have when I came here. Mrs. C was divorcing me after 20 years. Our kids wouldn't even come home when I was around if they could keep from it. The boss had sent word from the plant that if I ever stepped foot in the plant again, he was going to throw me through the window. And the window don't open. of everything. I was out of people, of health, of sanity, of money. And look, I had all the problems that anybody could have. But I came here for only one reason. Only one reason. I had accepted the fact that everything dear to me in life was gone and that I wasn't entitled to have it back. I didn't even want sobriety for myself because my life was over. Death was imminent, and I didn't mind that at all. But I must be sober to die, because I didn't want to die with the record. I had had a little experience in my last drunk. It started on the Friday before Christmas, 1945, and sometime about the middle of January, I woke up one morning with a clear head. Now, doctors, priests, and preachers have told me that this little experience is not uncommon to those who are in the very act of dying. I don't know anything about it. But I know what happened to me. I had nothing in me but liquor. I had done nothing since the Friday before Christmas till the middle of January, but empty bottles. And if Mrs. C were talking, she would tell you that when I went to bed to drink, it took 7 quarts of whiskey to keep me down 3 days. I don't know anything about that either, because I wasn't there. She was, so I take her word for it. And that's all I had done on the Friday before Christmas, the middle of January. And yet I woke up this morning with a clear head. And for a period of about 15 minutes, maybe 20, I saw me as I was without an excuse in the world. And I knew why she was divorcing me. And I knew she should have done it 10 years before. I knew why the kids wouldn't come home. I knew why the boss was going to throw me through the window. And it was not their fault. And I totally and completely accepted the fact that morning that everything dear to me in life was gone and that I wasn't entitled to have it back. And it suddenly became very necessary for me to be sober to die, which I knew was coming up shortly, and I didn't care. And that was that I didn't want to die with the record. I wanted to rub out as much of the record as good. I didn't want those kids and Mrs. C to remember me as nothing but a tongue-chewing, babbling idiot drunk. And the last thing that went through my mind before the curtain came down, and I was drunk again, and awfully sick and very insane. The last thing that went through my head, I remembered that I'd read Jack Alexander's article in the Post in 1941. And I said to myself, if I ever live to get out of this bed, I'll find AA. And then the curtain came down. And I had to die many, many times before I got well enough to hunt for Alcoholics Anonymous. But from that moment until this, I've never had to take a sedating, tranquilizing pill, drink a liquor of any kind. From that moment until this. And so this is the reason I've talked about nothing but surrender for 17 years. Surrender. Surrender. To get out of our own way. To be rid of the necessity for ego satisfactions. This is the only freedom there is. This is the only freedom there is. And that's what our program was designed to do for us. If we happen to come to Alcoholics Anonymous, not in a state of abandonment of self, as was my very good fortune, I came totally abandoned to nothing. Not to this simple program, not to God. But in my book, it makes no difference. I was abandoned, and everything I saw in the program was something I wanted to do. I loved it. From the first reading, I loved it. And I wanted to do it, and I'm sure it was because of the state of abandonment with which I came. But if we don't get here in that state of abandonment of self, and if we will do the first 9 steps of our program as honestly as we know how, one day at a time, by the time we get to step number 10, we will be abandoned. Because that's what those steps do for us. One of the things, one of the great things that they do for us is to squeeze us out of ourselves. To get rid of the ego in the squeeze play of the first 9 steps. Now let's just look at them for a second, just quick. Number one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. A twofold admission of defeat. Powerless over alcohol, physical. Unmanageable lives, mental. So we have failed physically and mentally. And we have to admit it. And for an alcoholic to admit defeat in anything is a switch. The squeeze play is already on, you see? The admission of defeat. Second, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Now there's an implication here. There's no sense in being restored to sanity lest we be nuts, is there? So we admit defeat. And immediately have to admit we're nuts. And the squeeze plays on. And we made a decision to turn the will and lives over to the care of God. Not only have we failed, not only are we nuts, but we've got to get a new driver. And the squeeze plays really on. Whoever turned over the wheel? I've got to drive, I can't walk, you know. And the squeeze plays on. And as bad as the first 3 are, the 4th is worse than all 3 of them. It says we made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Now if you think that's an ego builder, get your pencil and start writing. The squeeze play is really on. And yet, the 5th is worse than all 4 of those. The 5th says we admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Now, the first 2 conditions are not tough at all. I can crawl under this table and take the first 2, and nobody knows but me and God. But that 3rd one is a ego buster king size. Because here we've got to spread all this dirty linen out for some human being to look at. Now if you got any ego left after that one, you ain't done it. Start over! And the 7th says we were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. We've looked at them now. And we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. And there's not much ego here, is there? We're getting cut down to size. And the next one says we humbly ask Him to remove our shortcomings. The squeeze plays on. Now the next two are at once the toughest and the most rewarding steps in our program. Don't be afraid of these next two. When you get rid of these, it's like an inside shower. This takes so much of the weight off of us. We made a list of all persons we'd harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. And we made direct amends to such persons wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. We go to our people and we say, look, I'm not the big shot that I would have had you believe. I'm an alcoholic. And I found a way to live that might make it possible for me to be sober, not have to drink for the rest of my life. And one of the conditions is that we must make amends. And I'm here to tell you that I've done you wrong. And I'm here to apologize. But I'm not only here to apologize, I'm here to tell you that I'm ready and willing to make amends. And I will, to make restitution, and I will, as quickly as possible. Don't be afraid of these. These are terrific steps. And that's 8 and 9. And now we're down to 10. And if we have done this as honestly as we know how, we are now in a state of abandonment, whether we know it or not. These steps will surrender us if we will do them. And number 10 keeps us surrendered. Number 10 keeps us surrendered. We continue to take personal inventory, daily inventory. And when we're wrong, promptly admit it. You know, two of the great things that this program has done for me, besides sobriety, which incidentally is the greatest gift that any God could give me, sobriety. Because I cannot live and drink, and of myself I can't keep from drinking. So this is tops. But amongst the good ones is that now it's so easy for me to say I don't know. 17 years ago I could say I don't know. You could ask me anything and I would have told you. If you'd asked me how God created the universe, I'd have told you that too. And I probably would have said on the third day we did this. But now it's so easy for me to say I don't know. And it's so easy for me to say, I was wrong. I'm sorry. I thought I was right, but I was dead wrong, and I apologize. These are good things, and they come along with step number 10. And now we're ready for 11 and 12. And 11 and 12 are the steps that bring us into the AA way of life, than which there is nothing finer under heaven. We sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood it, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. This is a great, great thing, step 11. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious awareness of the living presence of the Almighty. Praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry it out. Now maybe you don't need that power. Those last 7 words are terrific in my book. I need it. I need it so much. And I need all of it I can get, the power to carry that out. And I've come to believe that the only thing I need to pray for is the knowledge of His will for me in the power to carry it out. Because if I've taken step three, the only will I can have from now on is the will to do God's will. That's the only will I can have. And so we pray for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry it out. And I'd like to take a moment to show you how I love this thing. A few years ago, Miss C and I had gone up to Santa Cruz to a Tri-Counties AA function. And in Santa Cruz, there are lots of these big redwood trees. And they're majestic things. And at noon on Saturday, they took us out there. And we were going around looking at this beautiful grove of redwoods. But this time, I had a little paper. You know, I'd seen them before. But when I saw them a few years before, I knew all about them. And I didn't have any descriptive literature. But this time, I had the descriptive literature, and I could read, which was a switch, too. And I was reading about what we saw. And pretty soon we came to a couple of trees. They called them the sister trees. And up maybe 50 feet, 100 feet above the ground, these two trees had crossed each other. And I guess they were annoying each other in the wind and all that. And something had to be done about it. So what happened? They formed a natural graft between them. A graft from one tree to the other and separated themselves. And I looked at that thing and I said to myself, why? Why is it so difficult for us, God's children, to come to depend completely on this great power? When it so beautifully cares for a redwood tree. It's not normal for trees to grow like that. You know? And here a natural graft to make it easy for them to live. And if that protection and care is inherent in the idea of a redwood tree, how much more for us, God's children? And we went on about, and the last thing really that we came to was a great big tree that had been burned out in the base 150 years ago in a forest fire. It had burned out. And what happened? Up above the wound, two limbs grew out and grew down and grafted themselves in the burn and healed. The burn. This is not normal. It's not normal for limbs to grow out and down and into the tree. And yet you could stand right there and look at it. And I stood there and bawled like a baby. Why is it so difficult for us to see that all we need to do is to abandon ourselves to this great power, and underneath are the everlasting arms. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God, our own God. Praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry it out. And then number 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. And there is an implication here. It don't say maybe. It says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. And I'm one who believes that you and I cannot do these things as honestly as we know how, one day at a time, without having a spiritual awakening. We tried to carry this message to alcoholics. So we find this great thing, and then we start trying to give it away. And one of the greatest things happens that can possibly happen to anybody. You and I have heard since childhood that it is in giving that we receive. But we never know this until we do it and find out. To give this thing away for free and for fun to the alcoholic who still suffers, trying to add to life instead of take from it, we learn that it is truly in giving that we receive. Now, how can I say a thing like this? At the ripe old age of 43, I was a complete and total failure in every department of life. I had lived for 43 years to the best of my ability according to the rules as I knew them. And all my wit and wisdom had gotten nothing but total disaster in my life. And in 17 short years, I've attempted to the best of my ability to share this great thing which was given to me. And in these short years, infinitely more good has come into my life than in the entire previous 43. And I have done nothing as such to bring it about. We learn this only in the doing, in the giving without a price tag, that it is truly in giving that we receive. And lastly, and practice these principles in all of our affairs. Now when you and I get simple enough to practice these principles in all of our affairs, in play, in church, in school, in AA, in business, in every activity of life, in the home, when we are simple enough to practice these principles in all of our affairs, it puts us back together again. We are made whole. And we can then see that there's nothing more or less spiritual than another. Nothing more or less important than another. That there is nothing to life but the living thereof today. This day, no reason for it but the joy of it. Not for my glory, but for the glory of the Father, in whom I live and move and have my being. And we are made whole. And this is the great living answer to the living problem. Fortunate are we alcoholics. Because you see, we have an incurable disease. And our incurable disease is progressive. And the time eventually comes when we can no longer live without an answer. And we come here, not looking for the answers to all these problems, not even looking for God, looking for a way to be sober, to live without the bottle. And in doing these things, we find that the answer for the disease of alcoholism and the answer to the riddle of life is one and the same answer. And it's nothing in the world but an individually, a personally acceptable, conscious partnership with the living God that made us in the entire business of living. This is our great good fortune. And now, How do I go about this thing? It's so easy for me to see my business out here. It's my business to go about my father's business, to share my experience, strength, and hope with anybody that wants it. Dad, wherever I can. That's so easy for me to see. And I love to do it, and I do. But what's my business with me? With me and our heart. What is my business with me? I must sit back a mile away and look at myself. And watch myself perform. And see the things that I can do. And feel comfortable inside. And accentuate those things. And see the things that I cannot do. And be comfortable inside. And eliminate those things. Because I must be comfortable inside. Lest I drink again. And so, this is my business. And I've gotten so simple with it. So simple. We moved 5 years and a half ago to Laguna Beach in my factories in Los Angeles. And I have that run to make, about 54 miles each way a day. And people say to me, Chuck, why do you add this on the burden of life? Aren't you busy enough that you drive 108 miles just to get to the plant and back? And I can't tell them. I have to have that time alone myself. Because it's then when I talk with my father. I go out through Laguna Canyon. And if you were following me, you'd probably say I was nuts. Because you wouldn't see anybody with me. And I'd liable to be going along there laughing and talking. And you wouldn't see anybody but me. And you'd say the guy's nuts. And maybe I am. But this time it don't hurt. And I might be saying, look, Father, I'm reporting for duty. Now I'm going to move it around the best I can. I'm going to do the best I can with what I have. And all I want out of you is a little guidance and direction and the power to carry out. Sure, thank you. And I go on about my business. And if I've been sort of off the beam the day before, and I've done something pretty lousy, and I do that, I might be doing something like this. I might be saying, look, Father, look what a lousy stunt I pulled yesterday. Now, isn't this a terrible thing? It's a good thing he's here. I'd have said a hell of a thing, but I mustn't do that. So I won't. Isn't this a terrible thing for a guy like me to do? I know better. I know even why I did it. It was very necessary at that particular time for me to make an impression. I don't like it. And you don't like it. And I want to do better. And with your help, I'll do a lot better. Sure, thank you. And I just toss it in the hopper and forget about it. And when the good thing happens, I talk with him like this. Look, Father, isn't this a beautiful thing that happened to me? This kind of thing can't happen to a bum like me, but it did. And I know where it came from, and I sure thank you. And that's the way I live. Expecting, asking for, and receiving guidance in all things. I am completely and totally dependent on you, the people of Alcoholics Anonymous, on the principles of this great program, and on our Father, God, as I understand. Dependence of love, it is. Dependence in the certain knowledge that I can abandon myself in complete and total assurance that he can do much better running my life than I can. It's a fabulous, fabulous thing. This is amazing, this life of ours. It is consumed, and it increases in interest and value as the days go by. I am convinced that we, as our Father's children, are on the pathway of a limitless and infinite journey. Today's step is the only thing in it that we must get lost in. But the journey is in. And the higher we walk, the farther we can see. And the more beautiful is the view. And this will go on forever. There is no limit. There is no top to the 12 steps. We will be walking up this stairway forever, because it leads all the way from the depths of hell to heaven. I know, because I've lived in both. God bless you all. Thanks.